Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's call. Experts discuss COVID-19 implications for immigrants in detention. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. Please note this call may be recorded. I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn today's conference over to our moderator, Eleanor Acer. Please go ahead.
Thank you all for joining us here today. Human rights advocates, attorneys, public health, and prison experts have been calling on the Department of Homeland Security and ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to release asylum seekers and immigrants held in ICE's vast immigration detention system due to the grave risk of COVID-19 illnesses, which endanger both the health of asylum seekers and immigrants held in these facilities and the public health systems of surrounding communities. On March 17, Physicians for Human Rights, Human Rights First, and Amnesty wrote to the leaders of DHS and ICE and to the governors of the 15 states where most of these facilities are located, urging release of asylum seekers and immigrants, a critical step needed to protect all immigrants detained and to protect public health. The Detention Watch Network and its many community-based and other members have also written to ICE, calling for all immigration detainees to be released. Former ICE Acting Director John Sandwick has confirmed in a briefing organized last week by Human Rights First and Physicians for Human Rights that ICE has the authority to release all individuals. It has absolute discretion. The Department of Homeland Security and ICE have been warned repeatedly of the dangers of a failure to release immigrants and asylum seekers from detention facilities. The failure to act is a recipe for disaster, and if steps are not taken immediately, many more asylum seekers, immigrants, and the communities surrounding these facilities will suffer. Today, we have a number of speakers with us who will explain the dangers that will result from a failure to act and the steps that officials must take now. Our first speaker will be Dr. Chris Beyer, a doctor and leading expert on infectious diseases. Dr. Beyer currently serves as professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The second speaker that will then be Dr. Jody Rich, professor of medicine and epidemiology at Brown University. He served as an advisor to the Department of Homeland Security and is a whistleblower represented by the Government Accountability Project. Our third speaker is Dr. Renit Mishori, a senior medical advisor at Physicians for Human Rights and a professor of family medicine at Georgetown University. Then our next speaker will be Dr. Alfred Aboya, an international basketball coach, former basketball player, and ambassador for Advocate for Detainees, a project of the Cameroon American Council. Our final speaker will be Silky Shaw, executive director at Detention Watch Network. Thank you so much, and we'll start with Dr. Chris Beyer. Dr. Beyer?
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks very much for being on the call today. What I want to talk with you about is why epidemiologists, public health people, human rights advocates are so concerned about people in detention and COVID-19 and why it's so important to address the issues of crowding and overcrowding and the reduction in people who don't need to be in detention. So the first thing to say, of course, is that there's a long history of infectious disease outbreaks in prisons and detention facilities. And right up front in the initial outbreak in Wuhan, China, there was outbreaks in prison and detention facilities in China. So we have empirical evidence right away that this is a real risk with COVID-19. There have been a number of other infectious disease outbreaks associated with detention and prison facilities in the past years and decades, and prominent ones that have affected the U.S. include tuberculosis and multidrug-resistant TB, outbreaks of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, in prison and detention facilities, and in 2019, a number of cases of influenza A in ICE detention facilities that were, of course, associated with the wider U.S. influenza epidemic. And very prominently in one of those cases, a 16-year-old Guatemalan unaccompanied minor who died in ICE detention last May of acute respiratory distress syndrome. And that is so important because acute respiratory distress syndrome is, of course, the fatal complication of COVID disease. In that case, he had actually been seen by a nurse practitioner, given one dose of Tamiflu, it's an oral influenza drug, and then locked in a cell and died of ARDS through that night. So we already know that people really are at risk in these facilities. What are the issues from an epidemiologic perspective? Well, the first is that density and population density is such a driver of spread with COVID-19. So one of the reasons many epidemiologists think the New York area is so hard hit is precisely because New York is the densest urban center that we have. And everything that can be done, of course, to reduce population density helps reduce the onward spread of the virus. That's why we're all being encouraged to practice social distancing and to limit interactions with people as much as we can. It should be obvious to everyone that social distancing is enormously challenging in detention, and particularly in crowded and overcrowded detention facilities with dorm-like sleeping quarters very often. The second concern, of course, is the hygiene issues, the water and sanitation and hand washing issues. So we are all, of course, encouraged to practice good hygiene and practice hand washing. It plays a very important role in reduction. That is enormously challenging in again, these detention facilities, shared bathrooms, shared eating areas, limitations often on soap, no hand sanitizer because it contains alcohol, it's banned in many of these facilities, and real challenges with hygiene, which, for example, have been noted in some of the detention facilities in states like New Jersey, well before COVID-19 was an issue. The next issue, of course, is the fundamental one of healthcare access. So as we know, the majority of healthy people and young people who encounter COVID and do become infected have a relatively mild and transient disease. That's about 80%. But about 20% of people will progress to more serious disease. A substantial proportion of them will need hospitalization, and a subset of them will need intensive care. And about 30% of the hospitalized population will progress to acute respiratory distress syndrome, where they will need real supportive therapy, including oxygen intubation and ventilation. That is an enormously short supply in many of the settings where these detention facilities are, and local hospitals will likely be unable to respond if there are major outbreaks, particularly in the rural areas where so many ICE detention facilities are. So we're concerned about the density, we're concerned about transmission, we're concerned about another issue which is very important to consider, and that'll be the last point that I make, which is that people often believe that detention facilities, detention centers, jails, and prisons are somehow hived off from the community, and that epidemics can be contained in those kind of settings. That is absolutely not the case. Most of these facilities have 3 8-hour shifts every 24 hours. People are in and out of them all the time. In the Wuhan outbreak, we know it was prison guards who introduced the virus into the prisons. The same thing happened in the largest jail outbreak we have right now, which is Rikers Island, where the initial cases were mostly staff going in and out, going back to their communities and families. And even now, the most recent data there, it's roughly 50-50 inmates and staff. So these facilities are also dangerous for all the people who work in them. And there is no way either to protect people inside from exposure or to protect the communities around them from the risk of serious outbreaks and the need for people to have advanced medical care. So for all of those reasons, we think that it is absolutely essential to reduce the overcrowding, to have people who are detained, if only for administrative reasons and who are not a flight risk or a security risk, to be released immediately before we start to see more extensive outbreaks of this disease among people whose liberty we have taken away. And I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Dr. Byrer. Our next speaker is Dr. Josiah Rich. Dr. Rich?
Thank you. I am a professor of medicine at Brown and have been also practicing medicine behind bars for the last 25 years on a weekly basis, and recently joined Dr. Scott Allen to work for the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties and in evaluating healthcare in these detention facilities. I recently joined. I haven't actually been to one of these facilities yet. Dr. Allen has been to many of them for more than 5 years. But one of the first things that we did is on February 25th sent a letter to our immediate superiors notifying them that this is a ticking time bomb, that this, just as Dr. Byrer said, this will spread like wildfire through these facilities and create a surge in cases that will need to go and burden outside hospitals at a time when they are going to be flat out and unable to accommodate that kind of burden of disease. So the we did not get a reply. We sent again March 13th and then decided that we needed to, because of the urgency of the system, of the situation, send a whistleblower letter to Congress, on which we did on March 19th. That has, and we've got a reply from Congress. I've spoken to a number of congressional committee representatives about that, and that's ongoing because of the tremendous concern about this. I want to highlight one issue, which is that a number of places are saying, well, we're following the CDC's guidance here. And the CDC's guidance that they released last week is focused on correctional facilities, detention facilities. What do you do to try and reduce and limit spread and triage patients and get them transferred when they need to? And how do you manage that inside a facility? And those are excellent guidelines. But they don't this is addressed to people that are running correctional facilities. But we need a higher level to look at this, because the first thing, the most important thing, is to get that census down. Many of these facilities are at capacity or above capacity. And when you have that, once it gets in there, it spreads quickly. You have no options to slow down the spread. So I think that is a critical issue. And the CDC guidelines are not aimed at people who have the ability to release people. Correctional authorities, they have no control over who gets sent to them and who they are allowed to release. That's typically higher authority, and in this case, that's the ICE as that authority. I can tell you in Rhode Island, it's been a struggle to try and sort out who has the central authority to release people from either jail or prison, and who can make those types of decisions. In the immigration detention facilities, it's quite clear. ICE has central authority to make those decisions, and really need to make that. The attorneys at the Government Accountability Project, who've helped protect Dr. Allen as whistleblowers, have pointed out that to me that there's been a number of litigation in which this letter has been quite helpful in getting people out. But we are already seeing officers, correctional officers, detention officers infected. There have been deaths. We're seeing detainees getting infected, and really, I can't overemphasize the urgency of this situation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rich. Our next speaker is Dr. Ranit Mishori. Dr. Mishori?
Thank you so much, Eleanor. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us and for your interest. As Chris and Jody mentioned, while officials are debating what to do, the coronavirus is already inside our immigration detention facilities. Last night, there was a confirmed case that was reported in Arizona detention facility, in addition to 5 positive cases reported in facilities in New Jersey. These awful milestones were not surprising to any of us in public health or medicine. We knew it was just a matter of time before the coronavirus would find its way into immigration detention. Already, some 300 DHS staff have tested positive for coronavirus, and 800 are in self-quarantine. ICE says that roughly 50 of its employees have tested positive. So this business-as-usual operation of immigration detention facilities will only expose far greater number of immigrants, DHS staff, their families, and the surrounding communities to infection, as Chris was mentioning before. But so far, the actions taken have not done nearly enough to protect health and rights. From California to Texas to Massachusetts, people in immigration detention are protesting and demanding greater access to information and health care amid the outbreak, as well as release on parole. In some cases, you may have heard, authorities have used pepper spray and excessive force against the protesters, who are understandably fearful for their lives. And as mentioned by the other speakers, physical and social distancing, meticulous hygiene practices, limiting exposure to others is really not achievable in detention centers. There certainly is still time to do the right thing. There is still time to save lives, but the window is closing very rapidly. At PHR, we believe that detained immigrants should be released on parole to self-quarantine with their families. This will allow for proper social distancing, for sheltering in the community where asylum seekers will have access to health facilities and community supports. Community-based alternatives to detention have been shown to be safer than a detention-based approach. They won't tax the medical facilities, which are operating beyond capacity. They cost much less, and there are studies that have shown that such programs show 99% compliance with immigration proceedings. It is a feasible, practical, and rights-respecting solution. And amid a pandemic, it will save the lives of immigrants, facility staff, vendors, their families, and the broader public in their communities. Otherwise, the insistence to hold migrants in detention centers make these facilities ticking time bombs that will only spread the virus farther inside and outside. What happens in detention facilities tomorrow will be determined by what DHS and state officials do today. A question I always get asked is, what about those who are already getting sick? Won't it be too late to release them? Isn't it too dangerous to release them into the community? People say the infection should be contained in the detention facilities themselves, perhaps even in solitary confinement. But this is a false choice, and it represents profoundly unethical treatment of fellow human beings. I know we can't really compare the two settings, but consider the fate of the cruise ships, which were finally allowed to disembark in Florida after days of searching for an open port, despite multiple deaths likely related to COVID-19 and some 200 symptomatic passengers on board. In that case, authorities were able to find a humanitarian solution to save lives with strict medical protocols, including self-quarantine. We didn't abandon the passengers, condemning them to rapid coronavirus spread, minimal protection, and potentially mass deaths on the ocean. So immigration detention facilities are even more primed, as Chris was saying, for catastrophic coronavirus transmission than cruise ships. With every passing day that DHS and state officials fail to act, the stakes become higher that immigration detention facilities will become death traps. Thankfully, there's some hope. Some of my colleagues and I have worked tirelessly in the past couple of weeks on emergency litigation to get people out, especially some of the most vulnerable ones, men and women with asthma, diabetes, heart disease, and other medical conditions. Some of the lawsuits have forced ICE to let people go free, and we hope to see more of this in the coming days. Thank you so much, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Dr. Mashori. Our next speaker is Mr. Alfred Aboya, Mr. Aboya?
Thank you, Eliana. Thanks, everybody. I'm Alfred Aboya. I'm a former international basketball player from Cameroon. I attended UCLA, played collegiate basketball at UCLA, and then played professionally afterwards. After I retired, I went to Mississippi State to get my master. I have a master in public policy and administration because I've always wanted to be a public servant. And as a community organizer, a community leader, and a public servant enthusiast, you know, I was disheartened by the story of the Cameroonian asylum seeker, Elvira. Elvira has been in a detention center for 2 years. She has underlying medical condition, which put her in a high risk. Dr. Breyer mentioned earlier that density is one of the drive to spread diseases. So she in a high risk for COVID-19. Elvira applied for asylum at the border in 2017 after fleeing Cameroon. Cameroon right now is a war zone and people are fleeing. She left behind two children and she crossed 8 countries to try to find a safety, hoping that the U.S. Will be her sanctuary. Elvira has now been in detention center since she arrived at the border. She fears contracting COVID-19 as she's, you know, her underlying medical condition that I mentioned earlier. Since giving birth, and then also she's asthmatic, high blood pressure. It's important that, as an advocate, to advocate for her, so she can, be released. And Elvira's story is not the only story that, I'm familiar with. There's also two other cases, and medical negligence has been the driving force of those complaints. We have a Cameroonian woman protesting in Texas. We have Cameroonian men hunger striking in detention center in Louisiana. So it's people are complaining about life in those detention centers. It's important. I mean, I'm looking forward for people questions later. I call on people, everybody, to join me. Please join me and ask for the immediate release of Elvira. Our petition is on change.org. It's posted on there. It's posted on our Twitter handle at Alaboya12 and the Cameroon and America Council page on Facebook and on Twitter. We call for immediate action for people to join us and ask for the immediate release of Elvira. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Aboya. Our final speaker is Silke Shaw of the Detention Watch Network. Silke?
Thank you, everyone. It's incredible to be on a call with a lot of folks who are doing everything we can to get folks out of detention right now, and thanks everyone for joining. Sadly, as we close out this week, we're learning of more and more people testing positive at jails, prisons, and detention centers across the country. And as Dr. Mershori said, in ICE detention, 6 people detained have tested positive in New Jersey and in Arizona. In several detention center staff, as well as ICE employees, have tested positive. We also know that there are many other potential cases where people are just not getting tested. The continued incarceration of people during this time is only going to exacerbate the impact of the virus. And by holding people in ICE detention specifically and subjecting them to an environment in which, as everyone has said, infectious diseases are known to thrive, this administration is prioritizing their anti-immigrant agenda over the well-being and survival of those in its custody, in addition to those working in detention centers and jails across the country. This puts us all at risk. Over the past 2 weeks, there has been a rise in hunger strikes in detention. This is a nationwide trend as people in immigration detention are protesting their incarceration. demanding to be released over fears of being infected with COVID-19. People are bravely speaking out the only way that they can, by refusing meals, knowingly weakening their immune systems. These are organized and intentional protests to demonstrate the level of desperation and fear that exists and the urgent need to be released from detention now. Just this week, we saw over 300 people on hunger strike at the Northwest Detention Center in Washington State, and currently approximately 100 people are on hunger strike in Virginia. We've also seen people across the country support the calls to free them all through actions outside detention centers, in cars, not huddled together, but in cars, and through social distancing, and targeting local and federal decision makers to release people now. The impact of these efforts, and also those of countless attorneys and folks who are litigating to get people out, has led to some releases at detention centers, with a number of the number of people who have been apprehended by ICE in detention decreasing by 1,000, so we have seen some releases. But we know that the only way to stop the spread of the virus and to protect people in custody is by releasing everyone now. Those who test positive should get the best care possible. And as everyone has stated on this call, ICE detention centers are not hospitals or clinics. In fact, ICE has repeatedly proven to be incapable of caring for people in its custody. And those who have to be quarantined should do so in with their family, be released to their family and in community settings where they're less susceptible to the virus. This moment has only illuminated the deep and historic problems with the ICE detention system, which has a long history of widespread abuse, abysmal living conditions, and medical neglect. In regular circumstances, people's lives are at risk due to substandard healthcare, malnutrition, and a lack of hygienic products. That risk is greatly heightened during a pandemic as severe as COVID-19, and Detention Watch Network calls on ICE to release everyone from the immigration detention now, which they have the complete discretion to do. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much, Silke. I think we're ready to open for any questions now.
This is Jody Rich. Maybe I'll just say one thing just to emphasize. We are very concerned about people in detention getting infected with this, and we're very concerned about spread and the staff getting infected. But the real scenario that's the major problem is people that are going to get sick and need to be hospitalized, that 20% Dr. Beyer was talking about. And I've just spent the last 2.5 weeks taking care of patients with COVID-19 in my hospital here, and I can tell you these people can get very, very sick. They stay in the hospital for 10 days. Yesterday I discharged a 72-year-old man and a 38-year-old mother. Both of them were able to successfully go home and be healthy. If they hadn't been hospitalized, they would both be dead. And that's what we're talking about. These people are going to need to go somewhere. Many of these detention facilities are out in the middle of nowhere. The nearest hospital is a regional hospital, you know, four counties over. And they only have three ICU beds, and you know, small hospitals that are having to take care of the whole region. It's not like we have a lot of ICU beds and hospitals waiting for the COVID-19 patients to come. Those beds are full already. So the deaths that are going to happen because of this unnecessary rapid spread of this disease and surge in cases right when we can ill afford it, those deaths are going to be, some of them are going to be people in detention, some of them are going to be staff, some of them are going to be people with COVID-19 from the community, and some of them are going to be everyone else who goes into those hospitals with heart attacks and traumas and anything. So this is avoidable, and we have a narrow window of opportunity now to avoid it.
Thank you. Do we want to take the first question, if there are any?
And if you would like to register to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. Again, that is star and one if you would like to register to ask a question today. You can remove yourself from the queue at any time by pressing the pound key. And we will pause to allow questions to queue. And we'll go ahead and take our first question today from Maria Pena with Telemundo. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes. Thank you so much for doing this call. We've been covering this issue almost on a daily basis. So I have several questions. My apologies because I joined a couple of minutes late into the call. But my first question would be, how many people do you think would qualify for the release, considering that ICE is not going to release all people in their custody? Number two, can states really force their release if immigration detention is a federal task? What response are you getting from Congress? ICE has told us that they are looking at things on a case-by-case basis. So how realistic is it for you to get any results from this mounting campaign to release detainees? Thank you so much.
So Sophie, do you want to start with that?
I can start with that. So
I'm in if necessary.
That sounds great. Yeah, this is Silky with Detention Watch Network. Silky Shaw with Detention Watch Network. There are about 6,000 people who are currently in ICE custody who have passed their credible fear interviews and, you know, could just be released immediately. I will say that in general, ICE has just a ton of discretion. Like, what is happening in detention is pretrial, which means that, like, the only reason anybody's in detention is for compliance purposes. And as Dr. Meshouri stated, there's a lot of, you know, alternative options, community-based options that are non-punitive, where people could, you know, be compliant with their immigration hearings. And again, all of this is being delayed. Everything is, you know, it's a really chaotic time. And so I think people being outside of detention is ideal. But right now, I mean, ICE has all the discretion in the world to release everyone. And, you know, former acting director of ICE, John Sandwig, has said, ICE actually has all that discretion. And so I think, you know, some idea that they can't release some people is not actually true based on what we've seen in the past, which is, you know, even folks who are mandatorily detained have been released. Like, it's not something that is uncommon. So I think there's a lot of discretion there. We do know that there's about 6,000 people who've passed credible fear, and all those folks everyone should be immediate released. And there's a lot more room to do beyond that. I think that this question on the sort of state's authority versus federal authorities is something that's just dependent on where you're looking at. You have because ICE is completely subcontracted out, you only have 5 facilities that are operated by ICE. Everything else is subcontracted out to either private prison companies or county jails. But a lot of these county facilities, there's been a call to decarcerate those as well, because again, people are there for pretrial detention. And so I think there is room to make that case for both people who are detained for ICE or U.S. Marshals, or because counties are choosing to detain them for pretrial detention, should be immediately released as well. And so I think there is room there at the state and local level, but it's something we're also trying to figure out.
Yeah, I would just add in on the states that, you know, they really do have an, you know, because ICE is failing to act, you know, they do have to look at what authorities they have to push the issue, whether it's through licensing or occupancy authorities. But they definitely have the ability to advocate and advocate strongly, because it's their communities who are going to suffer, you know, and families that will be impacted in their states.
This is Alfred Aboya. Alfred Aboya, I want to add to that too. I think, you know, the most vulnerable people, I'm talking women and children, and people underlying medical condition are the people, I think, who has to be, you know, considered first. You know, because of the aspect that I mentioned above. And the reason why I'm so animate and so I'm engaged with Freedom for Detainees is because, you know, our community, like people said earlier, like our community would suffer for that. The Vera sister is in the medical field. So she's in the front line of helping people deal with this COVID virus when her own sister is already in situation. You know, she's in the detention center. She has underlying conditions, and she's, you know, exposed to contracted that virus, and it will be deadly if she gets it. So as a community leader and the voice of voiceless, I always emphasize on that. You know, people with underlying condition, as such as severe, those are the people who need to be examined first, and those people need to be released. Thank you.
This is Jody Rich. I would make 2 points. First is that a lot of the planning, you know, governors are now looking at, you know, making state plans, figuring out how many hospital beds, how many ventilators they have. They're often not looking at the detention facilities. They may not count on a wave of other people coming in all of a sudden right when they're hit the hardest. So they need to. So your reporting on this issue is critical to wake them up to the fact that they need to factor that into their planning. I had a really good second point, but I seem to have lost it. Thanks. It'll come back.
Let me add something. This is Renee Meshuri from THR. So, I mean, we've seen cases where prison authorities, whether it's sheriffs or the courts, have recognized the vulnerability of the setting and have been letting criminal detainees out. But ICE detainees, many of whom are often locked up in the exact same facility, may have to stay in. So these are people, like Silke was saying, who are civil immigration law detainees and have not been charged with any criminal offenses, much less convicted of ones. And they're stuck in the same facilities, seeing the other people being released, and they are staying in. So that makes no sense from a public health perspective, and which is why, again, this is time to release them. Again, if you're thinking about infectious disease, how they spread in these settings, and what is the right thing to do.
The second point is that any decrease in the census you can do will allow the people running these facilities to do more cohorting and separating groups so that they can slow the spread, so it won't all come in a wave. So it's worth fighting tooth and nail to get every last person you can get out, but even a 10% reduction would give a little bit of breathing room, allow you to perhaps slow just a little bit the transmission through these facilities and maybe not hit the healthcare so hard.
We have a next question.
We'll now go to Acacia Coronado with the Texas Observer. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my question. I guess it's kind of like a string of questions. First of all, is there a concern that there is currently a lack of testing for people who are showing symptoms, and that these people who are currently symptomatic or in danger of death, either now or in the future, that some of these illnesses or deaths could be classified as something other than COVID, such as pneumonia or septic shock? And the next question was on the data that you mentioned that we saw in Wuhan, if you could please elaborate on that.
Sure. Well,
yeah, Chris, why don't you take the Wuhan, or take them both?
Yeah. No, I'll take the Wuhan component. Thanks for the question. So, early on in the outbreak in Wuhan City, there was an outbreak in a detention facility. It was investigated by the authorities. There were more than 400 COVID-19 cases among the staff and detainees in that facility. And it's an important epidemiologic point because it was in an investigation subsequently done by the Chinese authorities, was very clear that the introductory case was a staff member, guard actually, who was going in and out of the prison for work on a regular basis. So that's a part of, you know, why we're particularly concerned about COVID, because, of course, there's always staff coming in and out of these detention facilities, and there's already evidence that there was very rapid spread in that facility. This is something that you know, we noted, we've published on, we've talked about, concern that this would happen in the U.S., and this is precisely the pattern, unfortunately, that was replicated in the outbreak in Rikers Island. So it just underscores everything that you've heard so far about why this is a particular concern. I would just make one additional point apropos of the earlier question about the responsibilities of states and counties, and this is more about prisons and jails. But, you know, roughly a quarter of all the people who are detained in the U.S. right now, that's about 280,000 people, are there for technical violations, parole, administrative issues, many of those for substance use related issues. It's always been a question, I think, why we needed to continue to incarcerate those people. We're one of the only countries that does. But now it's particularly obviously a huge concern, and it's really unjustifiable in the face of this pandemic.
I would just, to your question about testing, I would say, first off, there is a lack of testing. And you know, again, when people think public health crisis, they have, they often leave out correctional settings in general, and in particular, detention settings. So there's not enough testing going on there right now. But in terms of afterwards, you know, if you're concerned that people are going to get sick and die and they're going to be written off, misclassified as, oh, just a pneumonia or sepsis from something else, I don't think anybody in their right mind would believe that in this setting. We know this is coming. We know there's going to be a lot of deaths and a lot of illness related to this. So I think the assumption should appropriately be that is what would be leading to the deaths. But, you know, again, I think my sense is that all deaths in detention get investigated to some degree. And, you know, if I was a pathologist, the first thing I would want to know if somebody died of a respiratory illness in this time would be what's their COVID status.
Thank you so much, doctors. Do we have another question?
We do have a question from Ariella Navarro. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, hello. So my question is about the fact that immigration courts keep open for hearings for people in detention. So this is a risk for lawyers, workers, immigrants, and the community. So I've heard some cases that attorneys are sick, and due to this, sometimes they are unable to help their clients. So I want to know, what is the situation on a national level, because some courts have been forced to close due to infections. Also, I want to point the fact that I went to a court today in Virginia, and I think the restrictions from COVID suppose an extra stress for the family because they're unable to see their relatives in detention. So what's the general situation?
Thank you. Silky, do you want to take that question or start with it?
I feel like, Eleanor, why don't you go for it if I feel like you're more equipped to answer that. Eleanor,
well,
I don't know if you're on.
That, so I would point out that that's a nightmare scenario of having a court still open and a crowded room and everybody in there getting infected and then going back to their respective either detention facility or home. Or I mean, that's crazy that courts, if they're not being run where people are separated by 6 feet, and even with masks, that to me that's just foolish.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just say, like, we have heard of like courts being open and continuing on in this moment, and it's just absurd. Like, there's not really much more from our perspective to say other than this is a moment when, like, the federal guidelines are only essential things should be happening, and these are not essential things. Like, people should be again, being taken care of outside of detention, be with their families. That's the safest thing for them. That's the safest thing for the people who are attorneys who are supporting people who are detained. It's the safest thing for judges, for everyone. And so I think ultimately, you know, hearing that the courts were reopening in Newark and Seattle and other places, it seemed alarming and shocking. And I think that's not the direction we need to be going in.
So if you were in
this is Renee Mishori, if I might just add to that, you know, at a time when the government or state governments are telling us that schools are closing, arts facilities are closing, all situations where people congregate and are closing, this is the same strategy that should apply to courts and to detention facilities. It just makes zero sense whatsoever to keep them open. We're also hearing stories of ICE detainees who are being taken to and from and moved between facilities. That's the same thing. The moment you're not allowing people to self-quarantine and you're moving them between facilities, between cities, between states, that is a sure way of allowing the virus to spread further than the immediate community. So it's really ill-advised.
This is Eleanor. I would just volunteer to share with you, Eleanor Eastwood, I would volunteer to share with you after the fact a letter that letters directed towards the Department of Justice Immigration Court, because they've really dragged their feet in terms of protecting the people appearing before them from spread of this illness. The other thing, though, I would say that it is really critically important is that there are things like bond hearings that can be conducted by telephone. You know, it's critical for there still to be ways for people held in detention to be able to communicate with their lawyers and to be able to access release, but to do so safely. Thank you. Sorry. One additional comment, I believe.
Yeah, finally, I would just say if you were in that courtroom today, you probably should go home and quarantine for 14 days and call me or your primary care physician if you get sick.
Do we have time for a last comment? Because I think we're going to need to wrap up in our last question. And then
Alfred Oboye here, I can add one more thing. I think we're all in this together. Yeah, sorry. I think we're all in this together because the COVID-19 affects everybody. Schools are closed. Courtroom should be closed, and people should have people detainees too should be, because I don't think in detention center you practice or social distancing, because some of those detention centers are crowded. Which is why again I'm always come back with a Elvira story, underlying medical condition. Those people need to be released, and they need to be released now so they can not expose themselves to that COVID-19. Thank you.
Do we have any last questions before we wrap up?
We have no further questions at this time. I would like to go ahead and hand the call back to our moderator, Eleanor Acer, for any additional remarks.
I think you're on mute, Eleanor.
As the panelists have all made clear, the Department of Homeland Security and ICE and the leaders of those agencies must take action immediately before it is too late. Releasing people, as Dr. Rich mentioned, is the first most important thing ICE should be doing. DHS and ICE cannot deflect or escape responsibility by simply pointing to the CDC guidance. Given the failure of DHS and ICE leaders to act, it's more critical than ever for state governors and state health authorities and other state and county officials to also take action and press for these releases. Thank you again all so much for joining us here today.